Cities and towns all over Illinois are grappling with how to handle the Trump administration's immigration policy. One risk of not cooperating, your local police department might lose federal funds. Here's Champaign Police Sergeant Jeff Kuhn.
I've reached out to our Department of Justice liaison, myself, to say, you know, it's unusual not to have the funding at this point, and I couldn't get any specific direction from the liaison.
Now, State Attorney General Lisa Madigan is suing the Department of Justice for just that reason. We'll also talk about two gun control laws Governor Rauner signed last week.
I believe this bill protects constitutional rights while increasing public safety.
Plus, murals are a great way to beautify city spaces, but what happens when there's not the know-how or funds to maintain them? We're going to be talking about preserving public art later in the hour, and we'd love to hear from you. Is there a special mural in your town? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks to Brian Mackey and Liz Westfield for hosting while I was away. Coming up later this hour, Illinois says the federal government is withholding money from local law enforcement because of opposition to the Trump administration's immigration policies. Plus, we're going to be talking about preserving community art, especially when it comes to murals in towns and cities. And we want to hear from you on this. Is there a special mural in your town or one that needs saving? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about that later in the hour. By the way, if you have pictures of murals, you can tweet those to us as well. Our handle's 21STShow. But first, while this year's legislative session has been out for more than a month, it's still a time when the governor can take action on bills sitting on his desk. And last week, Governor Rauner signed two bills that will strengthen gun control in the state. He also vetoed another. We're going to have more on that story and all things with state politics from the past week with two reporters who are on the line with us now. Dave McKinney, a state politics reporter with WBEZ. Hi, Dave. Good morning. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
And joining us for the first time is Shia Kappas. She writes, or she now writes, the Illinois Playbook for Politico. Hi, Shia. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Shia, let's start with you, and let's talk about these two bills that were signed into law last week that will strengthen gun control. What did Governor Rauner sign?
He signed two laws, as you said, that they take weapons away from people suffering from mental illness. And they extend the waiting period for delivery of newly purchased guns. And he's also talked about vetoing a third piece of legislation that would require state licensing of firearm dealers. And it's interesting that he did the veto, I think, just because gun control measures are really they're the talk of the year, really, given all the shootings that have happened. And there's a shift in the way even some conservatives are looking at gun measures. And so him taking a stand like that is seen as being interesting, I think, to a lot of people.
And Dave, can you explain a little bit more about what she is saying about what Governor Rauner said when he signed two of these bills? As Shia said, one would allow police to take guns away from people who were determined to pose a threat. And Dave, my understanding, there's a whole court process that will involve. But the idea is this would take guns away from people are worried about mental health issues and those sorts of things. It also extends a 72-hour waiting period to all firearms. But then he vetoed a bill that would have required new licensing requirements for gun dealers. Dave, what kind of line do you think the governor's walking here in this election year when we're talking about gun control issues?
Well, to be clear, he has already once vetoed the gun licensing bill. The legislature then came back and passed another one, and they've not sent that to him yet. And he's threatened to veto that one as well. So that one is kind of out there still in limbo.
Oh, thanks for clarifying that, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, these other two bills, they're unusual in that they seem to have backing of all sides. I mean, you know, it's a rare thing where you have any sort of a waiting period bill or even these red flag bills, which is this the one you talked about initially, the clear and present danger thing. If someone shows a sudden onset of mental health issues, that there are new mechanisms now to go in and get guns. You know, anytime you talk about taking guns away from people, that usually causes the NRA and the State Rifle Association to say no way. But here they bent a little bit. And it's politically, it's all about Rauner moving more and more to the middle, or trying to anyway. And he's managed to do so in a way where at least he's got cover from the State Rifle Association for signing these bills. Now, if you go to, some of the conservative news sites, for example, Breitbart being one of them, they come out and just hammer Rauner for signing the one that would enable people to, with mental health issues to lose their guns. They call it a gun confiscation bill. So, he's still got some problems on his far right flank with this, but it's politically advantageous for him to move to the middle.
And to be clear, Dave, it sounds like this is – oh, go ahead, Shia.
I was just going to say there are some state lawmakers, though, who are still opposing his vetoing. Terry Bryant says it unfairly limits due process, and she, of course, and others are catering to their far-right constituents who still, draw the line on any kind of gun control measures like that. So I think even though the NRA did maybe bend a little bit, there are people who are running for the state legislature who still are trying to, appease their constituents in how they view gun control.
And right. And to be clear, Shia, you've mentioned this, Dave, you mentioned this as well. These two bills that Governor Rauner signed, sounds like they had the support of at least the State Rifle Association, Dave?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, Richard Pearson has, he's the head of that organization. And, he praised Rauner for taking action on these, and he thought they would be helpful. The bill that would allow the guns to be taken from people with, mental instability issues. I mean, he thought that would drive down suicide rates and possibly help with, these mass shooting situations that have been cropping up. So, but I think given the threat that Rauner, given his past action and the renewed threat on gun licensing, that's a red line that Rauner will not cross, and I think to do so would completely inflame and anger the gun rights people, and that's something he doesn't want to do either. When his conservative base is at best shaky, and he still has a lot of work to do to shore that up.
And to be refresh our memories here, Dave, that again, that veto that he already vetoed, which he said he will veto again, he has not yet, is to create licensing requirements for gun dealers within Illinois, because right now there's just federal requirements, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And, the way the gun right or the gun control people say that, we regulate all sorts of, other businesses, dentists and on and on. I mean, why shouldn't gun dealers have the same kind of scrutiny from the state? So... But again, it's the gun rights people regard that as a bit of an encroachment. They're a little worried about what the state, a very blue state like Illinois could do on gun rights. They don't want they don't want to usurp what are fairly generous federal rules on this.
That's WBEZ's Dave McKinney. Shia Kappas is also on the line with us. She's the writer. She's the author of the Illinois Playbook for Politico, a newsletter that comes out every morning wrapping up state politics. Dave, I wanted to switch to another topic, which is the latest in the series of lawsuits regards to the Quincy Veterans Home, where an outbreak of Legionella, Legionnaire's disease, has been linked to the deaths of 14 veterans since 2015. So last Thursday, we saw now the 12th lawsuit, if am I correct, Dave, family in the West Suburbs suing the state of Illinois for negligence. Obviously, this is something that you and the folks at WBEZ have been reporting from the start.
Yeah, I mean, my colleague Tony Arnold and I have been on this since last October or November. And what this latest lawsuit involves is the death of a U.S. Army Korean War vet who died in October of last year. And it was Legionnaires that caused his death. And what really was difficult for the state about the death last year was that this came after, millions of dollars had been spent to upgrade the water safety or the water treatment facility there at Quincy. And, as recently as December of last year and January, the governor and his administration were saying that this facility had the cleanest water in the state. And, you know, they'd said earlier that they were, the situation was, they were really on top of the situation and what have you. And to have another resident there die what, you know, ought to be a preventable death, because Legionnaires responds in most cases to antibiotics if it's treated early enough. And you know, that's just it's a very difficult thing to have happen. What this lawsuit does as well is it puts it puts under the limelight legislation that passed both chambers of the legislature in the spring that would lift the cap on awards in these particular lawsuits that the families have filed against the state.
What's the cap right now, Dave?
Well, it's $100,000, and that's the lowest in the country. And it would
for deaths, to be clear, it's $100,000 reimbursement if someone dies.
Well, these are broad negligence cases. I mean, you could be driving, you know, theoretically on a state highway and have a branch hit your car, and you might have grounds to sue the state. Or if you trip and fall on a university campus, you might have grounds to sue the state. All these cases go through a really obscure legal venue called the Court of Claims, and that's where this lawsuit was filed, along with the 11 others that have been out there. But the cap would go to $2 million under this legislation that passed and be retroactive to cover all the cases with these families. But Governor Rauner and his people have been making noises that they are concerned about the costs that doing this might have for the state. It would apply not only to Legionnaires cases, but all other kinds of negligence cases. And they think that the state financially may not be in a position to do this. The governor has not formally staked out a position on the bill, but people around him, that's what I'm hearing.
Now, there were some bills that the Governor Rauner did sign regarding compensation for victims last week. What was that about?
Well, they didn't really involve compensation for victims, but one of them was a legislation that would ease contracting rules, that would speed up construction of a new facility there in Quincy. Rauner and the Democrats, you know, they put aside their bickering and settled in on a $245 million replacement of that facility that had been, you know, it's been in use since 1886, I believe, and it housed Civil War veterans originally. And so there was that bill, and then there was a companion bill there was an abandoned nursing home nearby that they were going to move these residents into on a temporary basis while the construction was going on. This bill, you know, puts that under the state jurisdiction. So, I mean, these are kind of non-controversial bills. You know, besides the Court of Claims legislation that's still out there hanging, there's also a bill that would require notification of families and residents if there are any outbreaks of Legionnaires or other communicable diseases at Veterans Home. They waited 6 days in this case to notify the public. The bill that is on Rauner's desk now would require a 24-hour period of notification. And again, on that bill, at least we know the administration is supportive of that based on the, you know, the witness slips they filed in committee.
Steve McKinney, the Rauner administration has maintained in these lawsuits that they're not, the state isn't negligent in this. And I wanted to ask you, because you asked Democratic candidate J.B. Pritzker whether what his position would be on that if he was elected governor. What did he say to you?
Well, I mean, he kind of walked a delicate line. I mean, he didn't outright say that he would, you know, if he's elected governor, that he would drop the negligence argument that the state wasn't negligent. But he did say that the families deserve to be compensated. So, you know, I from that, I think it's pretty clear that he thinks that these families deserve to be compensated for their loss, more so than what they're allowed under current law. So I think, you know, I think Pritzker is supportive of the idea of raising the, you know, raising the cap to $2 million. And I think, you know, probably what you would see if he were elected, I think you would see these cases get resolved fairly quickly. But right now they're kind of in a holding pattern, and based on the docket, these cases probably are going to go into next year before they get heard.
That's WBEZ's Dave McKinney on how this is affecting the gubernatorial race. Shea Kapos with Politico is with us as well. And Shea, I wanted to ask you about the Chicago mayor's race and a story that you had in the playbook this morning with Chicago mayoral candidate Willie Wilson, who was giving out $300,000 in cash at a church on the south side of Chicago. Did he literally hand out cash to people at this church service? Oh.
Yes, you should see this WGN video. It's crazy. He has a big giant wad in his hand, and he's thumbing through and handing out bills to people in line. My email lit up, Twitter lit up. Everybody was stunned by it.
Now he says it's for charity, right? So I don't wonder if you're running for mayor, can you just start passing money out to people and say it's for charity?
He's a businessman. You could say maybe that he's naive to the rules or ethics.
Oh, he's a perennial. How many times has he run for mayor of Chicago, Shea? I feel like we've heard Willie Wilson's name a lot.
That's it. He's run before. He's run for president. I mean, he's been around. He knows the civics, or he should know about how politics works, I guess. Maybe he knows too well. I don't know. He did or did not understand the optics of this.
He also said that he also said Governor Rauner gave him $100,000 of this $300,000.
Right. So he has a foundation, and Wilson has done this before, where he goes to churches and he hands out money. He feels very passionate about helping people in need, because he started from the bottom. He used to be a janitor, and then he worked his way up in life, and now he's a successful businessman. So he wants to give back, too. And he's done this before through his foundation, giving money to people at churches and events. And other people have donated to his foundation to help him do that, including Governor Rauner, who put in $100,000. So
not knowing that he was going to be handing out this money at a church, obviously.
Well, I think he might know that the money gets handed out at churches, but did he know that the money would be handed out at the church where he was speaking about running for governor? That's the question.
Right? Running for mayor, right.
And on camera. I think that's the big question. Did he know it was going to be on camera?
Right.
I mean, Rauner was there campaigning. Wilson says he was there for his foundation. I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Is the church going to lose its 401(c) status? I mean, you can't do that sort of thing.
Lots of questions raised there. We will keep an eye on Illinois' playbook for Politico. Shea Kappas writes that. WBEZ's Dave McKinney has been with us. One other note, I know you guys are going to be keeping an eye on President Trump's first visit to Illinois. That's going to be happening this Thursday, right, guys?
Yes.
Will the governor be in tow? That's a big question.
It is. Thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the country engages in its own debate over immigration policies, there's another debate happening at the local level. That's how and which federal policies should be enforced. We've talked about the concept of sanctuary cities and welcoming cities, and one of the risks that local leaders face should they choose to push back against a federal immigration crackdown is the loss of federal funding. We're not just talking about small towns. After Mayor Rahm Emanuel committed Chicago status as a sanctuary city, the Trump administration, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions, announced he would cut public safety grants. The city of Chicago sued, and it won, but now this battle is playing out in other parts of Illinois. Attorney General Lisa Madigan is suing the U.S. Department of Justice and Attorney General Sessions for withholding more than $6.5 million from local law enforcement agencies and other groups. The DOJ says that's because of the state's passage of the Trust Act. Reporter Lee Gaines from the Illinois Newsroom and WILL has been reporting out this issue, and she's here to help explain what that is and what these grants are. Lee, welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
We're also joined on the line by Vikram Amar. He's a constitutional law scholar and dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin, one of the places that's been affected by the withholding of federal funds, are also here. Mayor Marlin, Dean Amar, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hi, Nyla.
Lee, can we just start with just an explanation, first of all, of what's happening here? Because I think folks have heard a lot about sanctuary cities and the federal government saying we're going to start withholding money. How is this actually working? There's a program. It's called the Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistance Grant. What is that?
Yeah, so this is a federal grant program that's been around since 2005, and it's actually named after a fallen NYPD officer who actually was killed while trying to protect an immigrant who was giving information to police. So it's described in numerous places as the nation's cornerstone crime-fighting program, and it's federal dollars that go towards equipment, technology, drug treatment, reentry, recidivism programs, a bunch of stuff. And there's an agency in Illinois that's responsible for allocating this federal grant money out to lots of other local law enforcement agencies, including Urbana and Champaign police departments.
And Mayor Marlin, how does that work for you with Urbana? You're one of the municipalities that's waiting on these JAG funds. How important is this money for the local police department?
The JAG funds supplement our police budget. So, and as Lee pointed out, it's for extra equipment or just to help us pay for things that we couldn't otherwise do. So in the case of this particular grant, we actually had an intergovernmental agreement with the city of Champaign. They got the grant. We're getting some of the funds. It was for a little over $10,000, and it was intended to pay for leasing tasers with cameras, which is a very important tool in our toolbox. Typically, we get our funds at the latest in April or May, and obviously, we still don't have them.
So you were expecting those funds in April.
At the latest.
And
yeah.
How do you budget for them? What do you do when that money doesn't come in? Do you try to find it at other places?
Yes, typically. And in this case, we had enough money left over from last year that we can continue to pay the lease. But, you know, going forward, it's going to be a problem. And again, these funds, each department has different needs. Some people may use them to pay for body cameras. You know, it's a way to stretch our budgets, which, of course, are tight.
And Lee, are you hearing this from other municipalities across the state of Illinois and maybe even across the country? Is what we're hearing Mayor Marlin say this is happening all over?
Yeah, I think I know that there's a group of states out on the East Coast that are suing the DOJ over exactly this issue. Champaign is also hurting. Champaign's actually due almost $50,000 under this grant, and they were planning to buy a new laser scanner. They've also used it in the past to fund new cameras for their squad cars and also tasers as well.
Dean Vikram Amar is also with us here on the 21st. And in my understanding of the legal basis of why the federal DOJ, Federal Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has said he will cut this for Illinois is because of the Trust Act. So maybe, Dean Amar, can we just start with you just explaining what the Trust Act is?
Sure. So I've only got a few minutes. But the Trust Act is one of several statutes that states have passed as part of the so-called sanctuary movement, in which the state decides it's not going to give information to the feds concerning immigrants or detain immigrants longer than would otherwise be appropriate under state law just because the federal ICE and DHS officials want them to do that. So the city of Chicago sued the federal government, claiming that the conditions that the federal government were imposing under the Byrne grant, namely that states not pass laws like the Trust Act, that those conditions were not authorized by Congress and were thus unconstitutional. A district judge in Chicago agreed with the city of Chicago, and so did the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So the city of Chicago won at the trial and appellate level, so it should be getting its funding. But because, owing to a complicated series of procedural moves, because the trial judge's order in the Chicago case was limited to Chicago only, the DOJ is now taking the position that every state and every other city has to sue the federal government separately, even though, at least in the Seventh Circuit, that's Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana, since the Seventh Circuit has already ruled on the merits, all these lawsuits, like the one that Attorney General Madigan has filed, should end up being winners for the cities and states in the Seventh Circuit, because they're all bound by the Seventh Circuit's ruling, but they're going to have to go after the DOJ one jurisdiction at a time because the federal government is kind of playing hardball. Now, areas outside the Seventh Circuit, they may not agree with the Seventh Circuit that the conditions that the DOJ is imposing actually do violate the Constitution because they weren't authorized by Congress. I think the city of Chicago's arguments were strong, and the district judge in the Seventh Circuit were on firm ground, but maybe some other circuits might disagree. Ultimately, this may get to the Supreme Court, and I think that's what the federal government is trying to do, generate a lot more lawsuits so that one of them can get to the court.
And when it goes to the Supreme Court, or if it goes to the Supreme Court, Do we have a sense of where, as we're thinking about, you know, all of the debates that are happening right now in terms of another Supreme Court justice and the conservative makeup of the court, do you have any sense of where you think how strong the Seventh Circuit ruling is, if that would be upheld by the Supreme Court?
It's interesting because, you know, there was a case earlier this year involving gambling in New Jersey, sports gambling. That's the headline. The case was about sports gambling. It was actually about federalism and the interplay between the federal government and the states. So you've got actually two themes. On the one hand, the conservatives on the court are very protective of states' rights, and they don't want states to be bound by funding conditions unless Congress clearly created them and unless they're not oppressive on the states. So generally, conservatives have been protective of states. But then, as you saw in the Trump versus Hawaii case, the so-called travel ban case at the end of the term, there's also a strain of deference to the president when it comes to matters concerning national security and immigration. So you're going to have a clash of these two things. My own sense is that there probably will be five justices to agree with the Seventh Circuit and say that because Congress did not authorize these conditions, the government cannot impose them on states and localities. But, you know, depending on what happens with Justice Kavanaugh's hearings and going forward in the next several months, it's hard to predict with a lot of certainty.
And so I think a lot of people have also wondered about the legal basis of how the Department of Justice can limit this funding. Lee, how did the Department of Justice change the funding process this year to do that? Or at least to make the argument for why they are not allowing this funding.
I think Vic mentioned that there are these new conditions that are attached to the Byrne-JAG funding, and that's noted in Madigan's lawsuit as well. And so one of the big conditions is that it not violate a certain federal law. So that federal law prohibits states from banning communication between federal immigration enforcement authorities and state and local law enforcement authorities. And there are also these new rules or these express conditions is what they're called in the lawsuit that grant recipients provide the Federal Department of Homeland Security with advanced notice of an immigrant scheduled release from a correctional facility, and also requiring recipients to provide federal agents with access to correctional facilities to question immigrants. So there's those conditions. There's also this idea of not banning communication between local law enforcement and immigration authorities. And there was a back and forth between the state of Illinois and the DOJ, where the DOJ was saying, we think this law called the Illinois Trust Act is violating federal law because we think that it's going to ban communication between federal immigration authorities and local law enforcement.
Vic, I know you have to go. One last question to you. Because it's my understanding the language of the Trust Act specifically says that it doesn't ban communication, is there a legal basis for the Trump administration here?
Well, again, the Trust Act and other acts like it around the country are part of this big umbrella known as the sanctuary movement. And every state's law is going to be a little different in how it limits cooperation between the states and the feds. But certainly one way a court could get out of this box is simply say that there's no conflict between the conditions imposed by the federal government and what Illinois is doing by reading the Trust Act narrowly. But that might bother some people in Illinois, and they might pass a more aggressive law the way California has. So, as I said, it gets complicated, and we'll have to see how some of these other lawsuits make their way up.
That's University of Illinois Law School Dean Vikram Amar, constitutional law scholar. Vic, we'll let you go. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Lee, so as Vic mentioned, Illinois is certainly not the only state, right, with cities and towns that have created, whether it's a welcoming city ordinance or a sanctuary status, or in our case, the Trust Act for Illinois. What did Attorney General Madigan say in the lawsuit? Does she think that Illinois is being singled out here?
She does think that Illinois is being singled out, but it's being singled out specifically over the Trust Act. And I just want to add to something that Vic just said. So Lisa Madigan is arguing two things in this lawsuit. First, she's arguing that the Trust Act does not violate federal law, so it's not actually in conflict with any of these conditions that the DOJ has attached to this funding. But second, she's also arguing, as many states, notably New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, are also arguing that these conditions are unconstitutional. So it's kind of complicated to hold that in your brain. So, like, on the one hand, we didn't violate anything, but also on the other hand,
if we did violate it, it would be constitutional to do so.
Yeah, it would be unconstitutional. Like, these laws, yeah, they don't make sense, is basically what she's saying. They don't jive with the
Constitution. So let's say that again, because this is kind of complicated. The Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, our state Attorney General, is arguing in a lawsuit against our federal Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, that we're not breaking any laws here in Illinois.
Correct. We're not violating
any federal laws.
Any federal laws.
And she, but then her secondary argument was,
these rules that you have attached to this burn jag funding this year are also unconstitutional. So like you said, even if we were breaking these rules, then that doesn't matter because they're not constitutional.
And can you just remind us, Lee, this is one lawsuit. Vic mentioned a couple. How many lawsuits are going on right now against, because now he said because of this ruling, every individual municipality has to file lawsuits. We're seeing this happen all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, there's the states that I just mentioned over on the East Coast. They're all part of the same lawsuit. So they're suing the DOJ.
That's one. OK.
Together. And then in Illinois, you have the city of Chicago, which successfully sued up through the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That lawsuit could be appealed and go to the Supreme Court. And then you have the rest of the state of Illinois. I think what Illinois, it's interesting the timing of this, because Chicago won that lawsuit in April, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm sure that the attorney general was watching it closely to see what the outcome would be and whether or not, if Chicago was successful, if that would apply to the entire state of Illinois. And as Vic mentioned, Chicago's lawsuit only applies to Chicago. So even though Chicago is getting this funding, that doesn't mean that the rest of the state of Illinois is. So that's why Lisa Madigan is suing. But it's not like Urbana, as an individual municipality, has to sue the DOJ all by themselves. So they're under the umbrella of the state of Illinois' lawsuit.
I'm talking with Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gain. The mayor of Urbana, Diane Marlin, is also in studios with us here as we're talking about this issue of the Trust Act of Sanctuary Cities and federal funding. Mayor Marlin, I guess because the state attorney general filed this lawsuit on behalf of you all, was this something you all were thinking about you would have to sue the Department of Justice? Or what were you thinking in terms of what recourse you would have to do in order to get this funding?
We hadn't gotten that far, and we just don't have the ability to do that. And this is just one of, you know, a series of what I consider kind of attacks on municipalities from the administration. It's really frustrating to think you have to defend your city against this administration. And especially it's ironic that they're withholding funds for our police departments, which it makes no sense. I guess that bottom line, it just makes no sense to me. And we, you know, we have passed a sanctuary city resolution in Urbana. It specifically refers to the fact we will cooperate with the federal government if there are warrants involved. We do not collect immigration status from our citizens or from our residents. And this action, you know, just contributes to the overall atmosphere of uncertainty and fear. And that's what is so frustrating and maddening about this thing.
And do you feel like Illinois has been singled out here?
Well, apparently, among other states, and I'm really grateful to Attorney General Madigan for filing this suit on our behalf. I wish Chicago could have been included with the rest of the state. I wish we could have been considered together, but I appreciate that the Attorney General is doing it for us.
Certainly would have saved a lot of money, I imagine.
Yeah, and a lot of grief.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're speaking with Urbana's Mayor Diane Marlin. The Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gain is with us as well as we're talking about this issue of lawsuits between Illinois and the federal government, one of many over the Department of Justice and their grants. By the way, coming up, we're going to end the show talking about public art, and we'd love to hear from you. We're going to be talking about murals. And if you have a favorite mural in your city, we would love, or your town, we'd love to hear about it. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow, and we're going to end our program with that conversation. But we'd love to hear from you about public art in your city, in particular murals that you love. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about a lawsuit that Attorney General Lisa Madigan has filed against the U.S. Department of Justice and Federal Attorney General Jeff Sessions for withholding more than $6.5 million from local law enforcement agencies and other groups. The DOJ says that's because of the state's passage of the Trust Act. We've been talking about this issue with reporter Lee Gaines from the Illinois Newsroom. She's been following the story along with Urbana's mayor, Diane Marlin, who's been in studio with us talking about the effects it's having on her town. Mayor Marlin, when we think about when Urbana was debating, for example, the Sanctuary City Ordinance, or when the state legislature was talking about the Trust Act, did you think that supporting these kind of measures might have consequences for example, now with law enforcement and with policing and federal funding?
There was some discussion of that when we were debating our Sanctuary City resolution, but it was felt that the council as a whole and both the previous mayor and I was a member of that council felt that it was important to make a public statement. So our resolution basically is pretty simple and straightforward. It just affirms the basic rights of all residents in Urbana, whether or not they have regardless of their citizenship status. So if they call 911 for assistance, we will respond. They have the same rights as anyone else. We also thought it was important, just from a public safety standpoint, and people don't talk about this as much, is that, you know, many times immigrants are victims and are hesitant to call for help because they fear the consequences. And we really need to keep open lines of communication between our public safety officials and all of our residents and businesses, regardless of their status. And that Sanctuary City resolution affirmed that as well. It also specifically stated if there's a warrant out for someone, we will work with federal immigration authorities in that respect as well. But it's been, you know, blown out of proportion, and I think it's been used to punish cities. There's no doubt about it.
And to your mind, it certainly seems like everything that Urbana has done, everything the state of Illinois has done, is also perfectly legal, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah. And we have to remember, 18% of the population in the city of Urbana is foreign-born. 20% of the Champaign County residents are born outside of the United States. We are a very diverse county and city, and our economy is very much tied into our international population as well. So this is the actions that the federal government has been taking lately, and especially with related to this JAG grant, it just doesn't make sense in terms of the impact on the individual cities and on our ability to serve the community and to provide public safety and first responder.
And Lee, can you just remind us again the Trust Act a little bit more about the final version of the Trust Act? As we were just talking about actually over the break, what that final version looked like. The Trust Act was something that was written with law enforcement in conjunction with.
So looking at, if you look on the Illinois, the state of Illinois legislation website, you can see an earlier version of the Trust Act that was sponsored in Springfield. It included some extra things like forbidding, you know, federal immigration enforcement from using local law enforcement facilities, stuff like that. But in the end, the act that was passed, essentially all it does is forbid local law enforcement from detaining someone solely on the basis of their immigration status, which is something that I think our sheriff here in, in Champaign County was already not doing. He's been on record saying that he believes that detaining someone solely on the basis of their immigration status is not constitutional. So what effect the Trust Act actually had on a place like Champaign County, it's unclear whether or not it actually changed anything for this area of the state. I do want to go back to something that Mayor Marlin said, which is about fear and fear of cooperating with law enforcement. The reason that we have the Illinois Trust Act is because the sponsors of this legislation felt like it was important to make a dent in that fear and to encourage people in the immigrant community, and particularly those without legal status here, to cooperate with law enforcement, to see law enforcement as a resource for them. And I wonder, this is the question that I'm left with, is now that the DOJ is withholding these funds, supposedly, allegedly, over the Illinois Trust Act, and the state is having to fight this battle, whether or not that is doing that mission harm, whether or not the fact that the federal government is going after Illinois over the Trust Act, if that's eroding any sense of ease that people in the immigrant community had about cooperating with law enforcement.
And Mayor Marlin, one last quick question to you. As we're talking about all of this, I wonder how much of your time as mayor is spent on these issues of arguments with the federal government, this instability that you're talking about versus all of the other things that you would be normally doing as mayor.
Well, almost from the day I was sworn in, I've written letters over various issues. Last year it was threats to cut housing and urban development funds, a lot of social service funding. There's just a number of different areas that actions taken at the federal level have a direct impact on the municipal level, and this is just the latest in that series. And to the point about fear in the community and cooperating with law enforcement, anecdotally, I am hearing that people are afraid to. Who are victims of crimes are afraid to report them, and they are sometimes being targeted for crimes because people know that they won't report it. So it's creating the fear and uncertainty that it's just, I think it's unconscionable.
That's Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin. I want to thank her along with Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines. We'll tweet out Lee's reporting on this if you would like to read more of it. Both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For many Illinois towns, murals are a way to keep local history alive. They're a way to showcase that local history and also making the town beautiful. But what can you do once those murals start to age? What's the best way to maintain murals and how can they be taken care of? And what do you do if you don't have the knowledge or funds to properly take care of them? On the line with me now to answer those questions is Jana Groh-Herring. She's executive director of Sterling Main Street. They're an organization that's been working to preserve historic murals in Sterling, Illinois. Sterling's on the Rock River, just about an hour southwest of Rockford. Jana, thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Also joining me on the line is Councilwoman Tara Bedi. She's a city councilwoman in Streeter, Illinois, which is about an hour north of Bloomington. And just last month, the councilwoman helped organize Streeter's 5-day mural painting festival. It was called the Wall Dogs Festival, which brought 16 new murals to the city. Councilwoman, thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, good morning.
And we're taking your calls about if you have a favorite mural in your town. We'd love to hear about it. You can join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Let's start with Danielle from Freeport. Hi, Danielle. Welcome to the 21st. Can you tell us about your favorite mural in Freeport?
Hi. Yes. We have a mural in our downtown on the side of a historic building. And in the spirit of becoming a more cyclist-friendly community, it's a cyclist on a bike, and it's bright and beautiful, and yeah, it's definitely my favorite.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Councilwoman Bedi, I wonder how much of what you wanted to do for Streeter was what Danielle was just talking about with this 5-day mural festival. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. We booked the Wall Dogs, which is an international organization
4 years ago, and it lined up perfectly with our sesquicentennial. So when I contacted them and they said our first date was 2018, and knowing that our sesquicentennial was that year, and turned out Illinois' bicentennial was also this year, we thought it was just a great fit for our community. So we worked with the Wild Dogs Plans, fundraised for the last 4 years, and ended up doing 17 murals over a 5-day period.
Wow. And I love how some of the art highlights Streeter's history. How did you decide what the topics of the murals would be?
We had we started with over 50 topics where we tried to find whether it was a famous person, place, or just something nostalgic with our community, just because we wanted to celebrate our history with this event. From there, we had kind of our committee voted, as well as we had some social media where we asked people for ideas. We had our first fundraising event where we allowed people to vote on what they wanted to see for topics, and just kind of decided from there.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's murals, for example, that show Clyde Isitomba, the Streeter native who discovered Pluto.
Clyde Tomba, yes.
Yeah, which is great. So we've been talking about new murals. Jana, I wanted to ask you about old murals. What are some of the historic pieces someone can find in Sterling?
We started our first mural in 1995. It went up. It was just a local group of individuals who got together who wanted to see the public art project done. And so they started fundraising and putting up murals. But most of ours are, well, I shouldn't say most of them, all of ours are historic in nature, kind of telling the story of Sterling. The first one that went up was a street scene of our downtown as it looked in the early 1900s. We've got one of an electric railway car that used to run between Sterling and Dixon, Illinois in the early 1900s. It only ran for about 20 years. Just a lot of old industrial photos, the original bridge that connected Sterling and Rock Falls that was wiped out by an ice jam decades ago, our community's founders, lots of I mean, they're all very historical related and based on actual photographs that we've found through our historical society and whatnot.
And is it hard to keep these murals preserved? I imagine because of the nature of it being public art, is that a tough thing to have them maintained?
The maintenance piece, I think, you know, our mural society was founded in 1995. And though they were on a good steady stretch of installing one to three murals a year from 1995 through 2007. And after 2007, the group kind of fizzled out as people aged, things like that. They lost sight of each other, and nothing was really being done actively to continue to fundraise for the group or pursue new murals. In 2013, the Lincoln Highway Coalition came to us and wanted to put a mural up in our town, and at that point they didn't know where to go with it, so they reached out to the Main Street organization, which didn't exist back when the murals were being installed. We've been around since 2009, so they reached out to the Main Street organization at that point to help coordinate where the new mural would go, and then said, hey, you know what, we really need somebody to take a look at keeping these, you know, in good shape. At that point, a lot of them were starting to show wear, just, you know, fade from sun. You know, we've got a couple of them, you know, with city streetscapes now. You've got trees brushing against buildings, kind of damaging the faces of some of the murals. We've got some peeling paint, said, would, you know, Main Street be interested in taking this on and kind of becoming the future caretaker of these murals? And we said, sure, and haven't really gotten our footing yet on how to tackle this massive project.
Yeah, that sounds like a big project. Councilwoman Bidai, I wonder, with Streeter and the Wall Dogs, if they, I don't know how much guidance they gave you all on this, on the preserving or maintaining side, but I just wonder if I could just end by asking actually about the goal of this. We're thinking about how close you guys are to Starved Rock State Park. How many visitors Starved Rock gets over the years. I wonder, is that part of the murals as well? Are you hoping to tap into tourism and have folks come by?
Absolutely. I think we'd be, with us being in such close proximity, it'd be silly to not try to get into Starved Rock. There's actually a group that's trying to do like a regional Starved Rock country, kind of a big, there's a tourism magazine and everything based on that. So we did, you know, we advertised in that guide, Heritage Corridor, all the local tourism guides. But absolutely, we'd love to get people visiting Streeter just to come see the murals, spend the day there, visit our local shops.
Well, our friends at our partner station, WNIJ, have been reporting on this. They inspired this segment. We're going to tweet out links to their story so you can read more about this and see the great photos of these murals. But I want to thank Jana Groh-Herring and Councilwoman Tara Bidai for being with me. Ladies, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about universal basic income. That's the idea that giving people cash with no strings attached is an effective way to address poverty. One Chicago alderman wants to try this out by giving $500 a month to 1,000 families. So we're going to be talking about that on the program tomorrow. As I said, you can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on this or past shows. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.